I'm Ashley Bassett.
And I'm Catherine Logan.
And welcome to another episode of the Injury Report. So today we're focusing on core muscle injuries in the NFL, also known as sports hernias, most recently affecting star wide receiver for the Jaguars, Christian Kirk. But this injury is super common in the NFL, affecting players from DeSean Jackson, Kareem Hunt, OBJ, Mike Evans, JJ Watt, Adrian Peterson. It's probably easier for me to list the players that haven't had this injury than those that have had this injury. So it's about time that we cover this. So as always, we're going to start with a review of the relevant anatomy, talk about mechanism of injury, discuss some treatment options for these players, and then dive into what you all really want to know, which is how much time can we expect these players to miss, and then how do they do once they return? Are you one of the many surgeons who thinks that getting osteochondral allografts is a complex and time-consuming process? Well, you're not alone. But we're excited to tell you that there is a simpler way.
At JRF Ortho, they get it. They've heard your concerns and made it their goal to simplify the process. They're not just any company. They are leaders in fresh osteochondral allografts, holding over 60% of the global market share.
JRF Ortho is committed to accommodating your needs, delivering allografts usually around 30 days, and it's all on your terms. You choose your scheduling option, whether it's specifying a surgical date, providing a date range, or just requesting the earliest available allograft. Your preferences are their top priority.
And there's more. They offer pre-sutured tendons and meniscus, and ordering is as easy as a few clicks on their user-friendly online ordering system.
So why make it complicated when you can make it JRF Ortho easy? Simplify your allograft procurement today. Your journey to seamless osteochondral allografts starts with JRF Ortho. To learn more, visit jrfortho.org.
Yeah, I'm so happy we're doing this topic. It also comes up a ton in lacrosse. And it's definitely a little bit of like a pet project I feel like I have as far as trying to figure out why does this keep happening. So I'm excited. So we're just going to go over a little nomenclature, just sort of some of the words, because there is a little bit of variation about what it is. And there's different terms that you're going to hear. So, all right. So core muscle injury, sports hernia, other people will call it Gilmer groin, which I actually had never heard before.
Sports hernia. I never heard about that either.
But the big sort of call I think I hear more commonly now in the literature is athletic pubalgia. And that's probably what I think we're going to see more and more in the literature to describe it. But the crucial thing to understand is that it's actually not a hernia, which a hernia we think of, it's like protrusion of the intestines from the abdominal cavity. But this is actually a condition where it really just is a complex set of pelvic injuries that involve strains or tears of the soft tissue in the lower abdomen or groin area.
So if you're watching us on YouTube right now, you'll be able to see some really nice graphics highlighting the anatomy of this region, which is really important because there's a lot of structures that go into this region. Also highlighting the most commonly affected structures. So the soft tissues most frequently affected by core muscle injury are the oblique muscles of the lower abdomen, and particularly vulnerable are the tendons that attach the oblique muscles to the pubic bone. In many cases, the tendons that attach the thigh muscles to the pubic bone, also called the adductors, are also stretched or torn. And the mechanism of injury, it may be an acute trauma, but more often it's micro trauma related to overuse. We'll see these players exit with a core muscle injury, but oftentimes this is something that's been brewing for a while and just gets exacerbated.
Totally. And symptoms, they can appear acutely or gradually throughout the season. And they'll often come to you with more vague symptoms, like primarily in their groin or lower abdominal pain, and it can radiate even into their genitals or their inner thigh. The pain is usually exacerbated by athletic activity, so it doesn't really bother them too much at rest. But when they're cutting, sprinting, kicking, those are the types of things that are going to bring their symptoms on. And on exam, they typically have point tenderness over their pubic bone. So that's located at the front of the pelvis, and it acts as a pivot point between the abdominal muscles as well as the adductors or your inner thigh muscles. So these symptoms can be reproduced by a resisted sit-up. So we'll, again, like show those graphics on YouTube. Sometimes people even have symptoms like if they do a forced cough or a sneeze. And it's super important to evaluate for any underlying intra-articular hip pathology. So like FAI or hip impingement, these sometimes occur together.
Do you see that a lot in your lacrosse players? I feel like I saw it when I was in the NFL for the 1 year of my fellowship. I feel like I saw that linked a lot. People with like limited hip motion had these core muscle injuries more often. Do you see that in the lax guys?
So it's really interesting. Like you definitely see both the link of hip as well as these groin injuries or that athletic pubalgia. But the other thing that I would also see that I think I'm still really trying to grasp and like get an understanding of and work closely with the PTs is like, even if they had some sort of core muscle repair, so they underwent a surgery, oftentimes they would have this in their college years, they would still have different symptoms postoperatively. So the overall, the groin symptoms would go away, but a lot of them had like a glute tendonitis. So they would have sort of ongoing sort of like glute symptoms. So we're always trying to figure out like, is that something that's just sort of missed in the rehab? Like if we're thinking about the pelvis, like all as a ring, okay, if we've identified and fixed something in the front, like have we, you know, identified like, why are they still getting glute tendonitis? What about their glutes like being overworked? So we would do, and this is like Mike Ginta, who's one of the physical therapists that we worked with in the PLL. He would also do a lot of like lower abdominal testing. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really shocking how weak some of the strongest guys could be as far as like doing some of these like, you know, Pilates-esque type movements where they just have to have like a true core stabilization and kind of move their lower extremities without like letting their, say like their low back sort of, extend out. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like the part that we don't have totally figured out is like, even when this is addressed, and I'm obviously hopping a little forward, like, are we rehabbing it well?
Yeah, you know? Definitely. And are we like, I mean, prophylactic surgery is such a crazy thing to even discuss, but should we be addressing concomitant hip pathology, which is coming up in a major two-part episode. Stay tuned for that. Should we be addressing that in addition to pelvic and core muscle injuries at the same time to minimize risk of re-injury? Because I mean, it just makes sense to me biomechanically, and I'm sure it makes sense to you too as a PT and someone who does a lot of movement work, that having limited hip motion, it has to rotate through somewhere. So it's going through the pubic bone and through those muscles. So even if they are the strongest they can be, they're seeing a lot more strain than someone who has more hip flexibility. So it's just a really interesting thing. I felt like a lot of the stiffer guys, the stiffer wide receivers and running backs, I felt like they were plagued by recurrent core muscle injuries, even after having surgical repair, they'd get it on the other side or they'd have a recurrent tear. And I just felt like that was definitely late.
Yeah. And like you said, we're going to have a hip episode because we've been putting it off forever.
Yes. But we have a good guest who's going to guide us through it. So we'll get through it.
A little bit about the association with core.
Yeah.
Anyway, awesome. So I think you're going to speak a little bit about imaging. So I'll let you go on for
that. Yeah. So imaging. So there's two main forms of imaging that people can use. So MRI or ultrasound. I feel like ultrasound's more used for like the treatment things, like ultrasound guided injections. All these NFL athletes are getting MRIs, and they typically demonstrate some tears along the rectus abdominis, which is essentially your ab muscles and the adductor muscles attachment, or the aponeurosis between those two. And we have a nice MRI image again, if you're watching us on YouTube, that shows that tear with a nice arrow from one of the studies. So a study from OJSM in 2021 actually found that the presence of positive MRI findings was associated with greater improvement in pain post-surgery, which I feel like makes sense. If you operate under normal MRI of the knee with kind of vague anterior knee pain, it's probably a good chance they're not going to get better. So I think having a structural reason to operate is always a good thing. So I found that study very interesting. And then in addition to imaging, like I discussed, you can do ultrasound guided injections specifically of lidocaine to determine really where the source of the pain is, especially if it's questionable with some of those vague symptoms, to really localize the source of the pain.
Yeah. So I think let's move on to treatment. So first line treatment is really just some rest, some anti-inflammatories, course of physical therapy. And, you know, generally that sort of physical therapy sort of progression is really about like first doing sort of core stabilization type things without any sort of rotation, and especially not doing any sort of, you know, resisted sort of concentric type activity. So that it would be like, if you're on an incline bench and doing sit-ups with a medicine ball, that's like the last thing you return to. But if that conservative therapy fails, you're going to allow that athlete, they're not able to return to activity. So there's a bunch of different techniques, but to be honest, like they're very, not as well studied. So it's not like we have a lot of, is open or laparoscopic better. So I think we're really lacking in how, we can compare the different surgical techniques. But in brief, like the surgical principles are basically you're reattaching the rectus abdominis, to repair or reinforce those abdominal musculature to recreate the inguinal ligament anatomy. And then sometimes there's, you know, variations with the adductor. So a tenotomy, so cutting the tendon, sometimes there's a repair, but I think we're really lacking a lot of consistency. Yeah. And we're also lacking a lot of like reports in the literature to compare. So it's a bit, it's tricky to know what the best treatment option is for these guys.
Absolutely. So regardless of treatment, what they have, how quickly can we get them back to return to play? So numerous studies have reported a very high return to play rate for both surgical and non-surgical treatment of over 90%. So a 2021 study that looked at outcomes of non-operative treatment of core and hip injuries in the NFL found that 100% of players were able to return to play, but a little bit more on that study a little bit later. That was Tramer et al. In 2021. Robert Jack and colleagues reported a roughly 95% return to sports rate after surgical treatment of core muscle injuries in NFL players. But time missed is really difficult to estimate, as the majority of NFL players with this condition do elect to undergo surgery either very late in the season or in the off season, as we kind of alluded to. This is more of a chronic kind of, a condition that kind of sticks around and flares up. And so athletes really, they'll try to push it towards the end so they miss as little time as possible. So in the study that was just mentioned, the average return to play was about 120 days, but again, that was off season. The players that did have surgery in season, the average time was about 58 days. So that's probably a more reasonable estimate of the time missed for these players. And, you know, though we don't have a lot of data comparing surgical outcomes, patients that underwent laparoscopic surgery or that minimally invasive surgery returned to play quicker than those that underwent open surgery, which I think makes sense.
Yeah. So let's also talk, now that they're back, how is their performance? So how do they do when they return? So very well. So performance-wise, Robert Jack and his team reported that there was no difference in performance metrics for any position after core muscle surgery compared to their matched controls. However, the concern is not really performance. Rather, it's just career longevity and the number of games played. That same study found that players who underwent core muscle surgery were in the NFL for fewer years and played fewer games after surgery compared to the controls. This has been shown for non-surgical treatment as well. So though the study of Tramer and colleagues reported 100% return to sport, defensive players played in fewer games following hip or core compared to the controls, but the offensive players were unaffected. So I don't know if that's a little bit about like some of the other things we sort of mentioned, like even postoperatively they return, but they kind of have these still naggy things, whether the hip was not addressed or they still have glute tendonitis. And, you know, maybe those are the things that just like nag and they, you know, their career longevity is just not there.
Also, I feel like, and I don't know if you've seen this with the lacrosse, we talked about the linking of these pelvic injuries and hip, but even like other lower extremity conditions. Like I felt like we talk about the kinematic chain and how it's all connected, and it is like hip weakness can predispose to ACL injury or knee injuries. But I felt like these players, even when they got back, like they'd have like an ankle sprain or like an MCL injury or just something like some of these like kind of intermittent injuries that take them out for 4 to 6 weeks. So they'd have a lot more of those than players that didn't have this. And I almost wonder if it was just a strength and balance or a movement issue or just an altered mechanics of their lower extremity. So I felt like they were the more injury prone athletes on the team.
No, I think you're 100% right. So I think there's a lot to be studied here. And I think we also have to figure out, like I touched on before, the sort of the post-operative and the non-operative rehab and really do a better like full evaluation to understand how they even get there to begin with.
Absolutely.
I think it's really important, and I'm glad we touched on it for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you everyone for listening to this episode of the Injury Report. We hope you enjoyed our conversation today. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and now on YouTube to stay up to date on all things sports medicine. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review or a comment or a question that we can answer in our Ask the Sports Docs episodes. If you can reach us by email at thesportsdocspod@gmail.com, you can also find us on Instagram at thesportsdocspod and Twitter at thesportsdocpod. We love your feedback. Have a great night.
Hey, good night.